Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and unfortunately, my co-host Marvin Smith can't be with us, but know that he is making a positive difference in the life of one young man today. And as usual, we will bring you guests that will inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Now, each week we will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, with having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been extremely fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and authors who are sharing valuable stories and helpful information and who are all working to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound and hopefully make this world a better place for all of us. And we'll continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, our topic today, it's all about second chances. We're talking about second chances for young offenders, and this is a subject that both of our guests know a lot about. With us is Hassan A. Latif, the founder and executive director of the Second Chance Center. And as a certified addictions counselor, Hassan provides one-on-one and group counseling services for those in need. Now, a nationally certified cognitive behavioral change facilitator, he also directs the mentoring efforts of the Second Chance Center, which they conduct at various prisons and local community correction centers, as well as halfway house facilities. Now, after serving 18 consecutive years in Colorado penitentiaries, Hassan embarked on a career to help others avoid prison. And now, as a member of the Board of Directors of the Colorado Criminal Justice Reform Coalition, he helps to drive that organization's mission to reverse the trend of mass incarceration in the state of Colorado. Now, also joining us is Sean Taylor, who was born in Springfield, Massachusetts, but grew up in Denver, Colorado. And unfortunately, in the late 80s, at the age of 17, Sean got himself in serious trouble and was sentenced to life in prison. Now, upon his incarceration, he began a journey that he will share with us about trying to better himself. Now, after serving 22 years within the Department of Corrections, the governor, Bill Ritter Jr., commuted Sean's life sentence, and he was released from prison. Now, this former gangbanger and lifer is a case manager, mentor, and certified fitness instructor for the Second Chance Center. Sean is making the most of his second chance while doing his best to show others how to do the same. Now, Sean was featured in a documentary called Lost for Life that explores whether juveniles who commit murder can be rehabilitated. And that film, if you're interested, is available on iTunes. Gentlemen, thank you for being here and welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much, Alan. We appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, sir.
Well, I got to tell you, this is a subject that is near and dear to me. For those that know, they know that we work with at-risk youth, and we get them to places where they can get the kind of help that they need, and hopefully they don't end up having to go through what you guys have gone through. So, you know, one of the things that I also want to mention is Hassan has a book, and in that book, which is called Never Going Back, Seven Steps to Staying Out of Prison. Hassan, you describe how these steps are based upon clinical theories, yet you've translated them so to be a little more palatable to this uniquely challenging population. Can you share with us these steps and how you've translated them?
Yes, absolutely. Alan, I myself have gone through a transition process that involved therapeutic communities both inside of prison as well as upon my release to an additional therapeutic community. And these settings are sometimes so challenging that, one, people wouldn't subject themselves to it or feel that it was a setting conducive to their personality. Likewise, in prison, these sort of programs are typically avoided by general population. I was one who was encouraged to pursue this course of self-exploration, can I say? Mm-hmm. And so what we've done is in this book is my attempt was to take this experience and translate it in a way that seemed less imposing, less clinical, and more real, for lack of a better phrase. And so that was my intent. It was my hope that it would be a guide and a tool to help navigate these challenges. The first step in the seven mm-hmm. that are detailed in this book is called Own Your Own Crap, which is basically about accountability, Alan. We believe yep. that this is where change starts for everyone with a challenged life, is accepting responsibility for their own actions and their own decision-making and their part in the process of whatever has brought their life to the place they find it. And without that, we think it makes the rest of it pretty difficult to approach. The second step is entitled Baggage Dump, mm-hmm. Which basically deals with discarding those things that we carry from one experience to another, from one relationship or one setting to another, that continue to impact our perceptions and our views of life. We think that when people process new experiences and new information through old filters, things tend to look the same. And mm-hmm. so what we find with a lot of our population, we think one of the biggest reasons for recidivism is the lack of a person's vision for their life being different. And typically, if someone doesn't see their life capable of being different significantly, they tend to do the same things. They just try to do them better. And we know that this is a formula for failure and not success.
Now, before you go on, give us an example of that, because that's one of the subjects that we have talked about before. We have a nonprofit that works with breaking up human trafficking rings, and that's one of the biggest issues that we have had, is the fact that we rescue these women out of that scenario, and they go right back in. And I think that you bring up a great point from the standpoint of this baggage dump. You know, what are some of the things that can be done so that they realize that they have value, that there are opportunities out there for them to take on a completely different life and something that they're going to feel very proud of?
Well, that's a great question, Alan. And, you know, I start the book by sharing a Kenyan proverb, which states, "The child is the father of the man, and conversely, the mother of the woman." And what this proverb is saying is that whatever we're exposed to, nurtured from, or impacted by as children directly results in the type of adult we become. And this is not some blanket excuse for why people do what they do or make the decisions that they make, but what it does is sometimes highlights the things that get us into the mindset or the pattern of making decisions and making life choices. And so We don't believe that you can make significant and sustainable changes unless you understand those things have got you where you are. But whether that's addicted to some substances, alcohol or other drugs, or whether it finds you typically being drawn to dysfunctional relationships or abusive relationships or ultimately incarceration. So we want to try to, when we do assessments with our clients, we want to really try to find out as much without being so obviously intrusive. Find out as much about their background as possible. So when you talk about someone, for instance, who was raised in a setting where they weren't encouraged to be assertive, or they weren't encouraged to be expansive about their thoughts for their future, mm-hmm. or where they may have been victimized literally or sometimes brutally victimized, we try to make help assist in a shift in perspective where people stop seeing themselves as victims mm-hmm. and live in that victim stance and see themselves as not just participants, but directors of their own life flow as much as that's possible. And so what we find is sometimes the things that help people survive very traumatic and very dysfunctional settings are things that they carry on even when their life is quite different. Mm-hmm. So if you're accustomed to being isolating, if you're accustomed to being very guarded with your emotions or very, very secretive about the kind of things you're feeling or going through, then that's the kind of baggage that we try to get people to acknowledge, because sometimes those things keep us locked in cycles. And if you had asked me, for instance, about victim stance, I would have told you that that wasn't a problem of mine. But in actuality, most of my life I spent blaming other people for why my situation was what it was. And we find that once someone is able to acknowledge these things about themselves, then we encourage the 180. So in other words, if I've had a part in my life being this bad, then I can actually make it that good. All I have to do is put a shift in my perspective and bring to it the same commitment that I brought to a life before. You mentioned some very specific incidences of trafficking and situations like that. We have clients who were raised in families that had all kinds of things going on, violence in the home, alcoholism and substance abuse in the home, and these are the kind of things that's come to seem normal to people.
Right.
And something to be expected, and to resolve conflict with violence. This is something that was a big issue in the press recently where it concerned corporal punishment of children. Mm-hmm. And my personal belief is that sometimes that's where a child first learns to resolve conflict with violence, if that's how he's been approached or she's been approached. And so these are the kind of things we talk about, baggage,
right,
bringing from one situation to the next.
Now, one of the things that I love about the way that you're explaining this, and it goes back to what we said about the fact that you're translating it, because what I see is that for many of us who may have gone to school to study psychology, and we're learning something and how to explain it it could be in a Freudian fashion, or it could be in some other way of explaining this, but in many cases, I mean, I can't see how is that going to translate to somebody who has gone through the things you're talking about, who has been raised in such a way that they were told completely differently. And I know that that's one of the things that we talk about in our own training, which is, you know, not to sit there, you know, sort of, if you could visualize somebody who's sitting there, you know, with a degree in psychology and their arms crossed and pointing out all of the things that have been wrong about the way in which they've handled their life. Nobody's going to relate to that, nor are they really going to listen, and they're probably going to turn off after about the first 5 minutes. So again, what I'm talking about is just how great I think it is the fact that you're able to translate and talk to them and come from a place that I really feel like they're listening.
Well, let me explain what I think is a part of the mindset of the population that we serve. Mm-hmm. And we look for ways to marginalize when we feel marginalized. We look for a way to minimize or discard the opinions of others, especially when we're being advised to make changes. So we look for ways that we can discount what people offer. And I was one of those as well. The professionals that you're describing, I'm careful not to cloak them all in one covering and
right,
dismiss them. because I've had some pretty skilled professionals that were very, very significant parts of my transition process. And I'm very grateful and thankful that I had this interaction with them. But by the same token, we're dealing with a population, like I said, that are looking for ways to discount what's being offered if it's about change. So where it concerns Second Chance Center, first of all, the core staff of Second Chance Center, you mentioned myself and you mentioned Sean, but we also have Sheikh Adam on staff. The three of us together have over 75 years of consecutive years incarcerated. And so no one can come into our center and tell us anything about doing time. We've been there, we've done that. We don't give the clients a lot of time to moan and complain and whine about the difficulties, because we've also faced those difficulties and challenges, still do, and we found a way to navigate them. So what we try to do with our clients, Alan, is we don't want to minimize some horrific, sometimes horrific histories, but we want to empower. So we say, take whatever it is you've experienced as invalid, as unjust, as brutal, as traumatic as it may have been, and put it into one category or another. You pick whichever one you're most comfortable with. And then we offer them these two categories. So what, or now what? Because from either one of those platforms, we think someone can be launched into a position of empowerment, you know, instead of being trapped by what's already happened.
All right. Well, let's. I want to come back. You know, so that's kind of the teaser. Everybody's got to keep listening because they know there's more steps. We only went through two of the steps, and there's seven. Yes. So everybody, stay with us. But Sean, I've got a question for you. And in the documentary in which you were featured, and again, it was called, for those that didn't hear the introduction, Lost for Life. And it explored whether juveniles who commit murder can be rehabilitated. What was their conclusion and why?
I would say that there was no conclusion. You know, it all depends on the perspective from which you are watching the movie. Mm-hmm. And how you feel personally about the situation. I am not the exception, you know, at all. Mm-hmm. to the rule that we can be quote unquote rehabilitated. There's many men and women who are in prison right now who are convicted as juveniles who are mere scholars. Mm-hmm. Because of all of the books that they've read and because of the path that they've taken in life, and they're also very compassionate, very empathetic people because of the changes that they've made in their life. So I would say that, once again, it all depends on, you know, how you look at the situation, because just yesterday, the director of the film, Mr. Joshua Rofe, texts me, and actually put on Facebook, where someone was saying some very, very negative things about mm-hmm. myself, about the other guys who were convicted as juveniles in the film. He was saying things like, they killed someone, they don't deserve a second chance, and if they claim to believe in God, then they should get ready for hell, and, you know, this, that, and the other in this Christian nation of ours. We have these types of voices coming at us. But I would say it all just goes back to how you approach your faith. How mm-hmm. you do you feel as if young men and women who made the worst mistake of their lives deserve a second chance? I believe that we all deserve a second chance, because I believe whether you were a juvenile when you did something stupid or you were an adult, you should not be judged by the worst thing that you've done in your life, for the rest of your life. So, you know, rehabilitation is a word that is thrown out there, but the fact is there needs to be a shift in your soul and in your mind in order to become a loving and productive member of our society.
Now, Now, Sean, you know, and obviously you've been very open in regards to, you know, to what you've been through. When people say things like this, does it, I mean, well, first of all, I mean, how does that make you feel? Well, let me start with that. So, I mean, how does that make you feel at that point?
Josh sent it to me, my response was, thank God for freedom of expression.
Uh-huh.
Because I don't feel negative. I don't feel like, well, they don't know me, so why are they saying these things? I don't have a bunch of negative emotions from that. I respect the fact that people have been blessed with their own opinion, and they can continue to have those opinions, and you have the right to feel however you want to feel about a situation, especially if you have ever been victimized in your life. If you've ever been the victim of a crime, you have the right to feel the way, whatever way you want to feel. But I would just say that there's another woman in the film. Her name is Charlotta Evans.
Uh-huh.
And Charlotta is a friend of mine, but Charlotta's 3-year-old son, Kason Evans,
uh-huh,
was killed at the age of 3. Yeah, I said that. He's 3 years old. He was 3 years old. He was killed in a drive-by shooting. And the young man who killed her son was 14 years old at the time. And he was not trying to kill 3-year-old Kason. He was just shooting.
Right.
And he ended up killing Kason, but one thing that overcame Charlotta as the mother of a 3-year-old victim, the feeling of forgiveness came over her.
Uh-huh.
Now, if this mother of a 3-year-old baby boy could forgive the young man who killed her son, then why is it so hard for the rest of us to forgive?
I think that's a great point, and it's one of the things I thought of when you mentioned of us being a Christian society, and how people were saying, you know, that some were saying, you know, that means you have to go to hell and so on. And the thought that came to my mind is that, you know, if that person is using their faith to come to that, then they're missing a huge part of their faith, which is what you just pointed out, you know, that ability to forgive. So on that note, I want to take a break. But again, for everybody, please, you know, we'll be right back. And again, we are talking about second chances.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and we're talking with Hassan Latif and Sean Taylor, and we're talking about second chances. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can. We're right here.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I was concerned. I couldn't hear on this end. Sean, If you could say one thing to your victim besides you're sorry, what would it be?
It would be that I'm at your service. I am here. The young man who was killed in my case, his name was Dean Rahim. And I think that that is very ironic because his name actually means something to myself, because I am a Muslim, and his name means a merciful life. And I would say that I'm dedicating my life to the cause of trying to make sure that young men don't lose their lives like he lost his for senseless violence. And I am at the service of him and his family. His mother read a very beautiful poem to me when I was at my sentencing, and it was about young African-American men in the neighborhoods killing each other for no reason. And that poem always stuck with me throughout the 22 years that I was in prison. And it never ceases to amaze me the forgiveness that is within a mother's heart, because she looked at my mother and she said, "This is not a time for celebration." She said, "Ma'am, you're about to lose your baby for a very long time, and I've already lost mine." So I take these things into consideration every day when I wake up. You know, I'm not out here just because my sentence has been commuted and I'm doing the work that I'm doing. I'm not out here to just have fun and party and celebrate the fact that I'm free, or celebrate the fact that I've gained my liberation. I'm here to do the work of trying to make sure that young men and women put those guns down, and that there are people out here, including myself, my big brother, my mentor, Hassan Latif, my brother, Sheikh Adam, who spent 33 years in the federal prison. There are people out here who love these quote-unquote at-risk youth, and we're willing to put our arms around them and let them know that there is someone who is going to miss them. If they make the same kind of mistake that I made, there's someone who is going to miss them when they're gone. We are going to miss them if they make those mistakes or if their lives are taken. So we do whatever we can to make sure that these young people have all of the resources in order to live prosperous lives.
Mm-hmm. Now, were both of you in gangs prior to the crimes that sent you to prison?
I was in a gang. This is Sean. I was
Sean?
In a gang, but...
Let me ask you, Sean, then, because I think, you know, I mean, gangs is a huge problem, and there's a lot more to it probably than we could talk about, you know, in just this one interview. But let me ask you this. I mean, what do you feel was lacking in your life that made the gang life appealing to begin with?
A lack of positive male role models. A huge lack of positive male role models, because my father went to prison when I was about 6 years old due to a heroin addiction that he had. And most of the men that were around me at the time in the neighborhood that I grew up in, most of them were into things like gangs, selling drugs or doing drugs, crimes of this nature. And so these were the men that I ended up looking up to. It's not like, you know, other neighborhoods where you end up looking up to the guy who's going to Harvard and is going to be on the rowing team at Yale or is going to be DU law school to get his degree in law, or going to some sort of a medical school to become a doctor. You know, these are the guys that privileged kids look up to. But in our neighborhoods, we end up looking up to the pimps and the drug dealers and things like that. So I would say it was a lack of positive male role models that led myself and many other young people in our neighborhoods to gangs.
Now, let me ask both of you this. In you know that I'm assuming that we're in the same general age group. we've been around a few years. Now, in this day and age of everybody being able to be in contact with everybody, so in other words, there, you know, between television, between the internet, between all of the social media and everything else, is this a tool that we can use to our advantage to be able to show people of all neighborhoods more positive role modeling?
Well, first of all, you're very kind to even consider me as in the same age group, Alan. I'll be 60 my next birthday. So thank you very much. Actually, you know what I find coming from a different generation than Sean is that it's even more challenging and more difficult for the youth today because there's such a vast access to influential kinds of information. I mean, when I was a kid growing up in public schools in Brooklyn, New York, at 6 years old, I was the guy in first grade because I had a deck of cards that had naked women on them with tassels on their breasts. You couldn't even say anything, but I was the guy because I had this kind of access. Now all they have to do is go to their phone and they can see anything, hear anything, and be influenced by some of the most horrific kinds of offerings. So we feel really at war sometimes with certain media outlets. But now you're asking, can it be used in a beneficial way? We think that it can. We have a website that we'd like to invite your listeners to, which is www.sccolorado.org. And we're constantly trying to build up the capacity for this site. And we're going to be having what we hope are the kind of beneficial offerings, video-wise, audio sometimes, that might help feed this need. You had asked early, not to go offline with your question, Alan, but you had asked about my involvement coming up, gang involvement, and that wasn't my history, but I started using alcohol and other drugs at age 5, Alan. So my influence very early on was impacted by this kind of offering. And raised in a home and in a family and in a neighborhood where violence was pretty commonplace, it set in motion for me my approach to other things in life, and they involved those same things, drugs and violence.
Now, I mean, with that in mind, because again, we're talking about juvenile offenders, you're talking about getting started way early. I mean, we most of the concern that we have are the kids that are, you know, in the teenage years, that they're starting to act out and stuff. It's hard to even wrap my mind around, starting with, drug and alcohol issues at such an early age.
Someone asked me, Alan, how do you start getting high at 5? And my answer was with the help of adults.
Yes.
I think sometimes when people think that the teen years are these critical years of decision-making errors, I think it's years too late to start focusing on the problem at that time, because for many, many children in those ages, they've already had experiences that have set in mind how they perceive the world and themselves in it. And, when they talk about the school-to-prison pipeline, this is not some cliche, Alan. This is very real. And though we're not involved with children that young, We certainly see them coming to us in their teens with a life of experiences that even, you know, I can't match looking back on my own.
Well, now you just brought up something about the school to prison pipeline, and so one of the questions, and this is a question that came in via email, and again, I want to thank everybody who takes the time to send us an email. I know that you can't always listen live, but we do appreciate this. This particular question is near and dear to my heart as well. This one reads, there seems to be an explosion of private prisons being built in the U.S. Are our government officials focusing too much on punishment and not enough on education and rehabilitation?
Well, you know, that's a great question from your listener. And the answer to that quite simply is yes. Uh-huh. I mean, if you just look in the state of Colorado, it costs over $32,000 a year to house one person in prison. All right. And if we were thinking about diverting some of those funds, while the same time prison budgets are being increased in Colorado and in other states in America, the budgets for education are being decreased.
Exactly. So
this begs the question, you know, what's the purpose? When you start talking about private prisons, it's not just private prisons anymore, Alan. They're private probation agencies. There are more people on probation in the United States now than ever before. And there are private businesses, private organizations and corporations that are in the probation business and providing case management for people on probation, providing mental health and substance abuse classes. It's a money-making event. When you talk about private prisons, you're talking about, for the most part, two corporations, Alan.
Uh-huh.
We're talking about CCA, and we're talking about the GEO Group. And between these two organizations, they own 74.6% of the private prisons in America. And they're on the New York Stock Exchange. So we did a thing in an event in Denver in February, Black History Month, and it was a community-based forum on the film Slavery by Another Name,
uh-huh.
which started with speaking about the institution of Jim Crow laws back in the day and how recently freed slaves were actually put back into another form of bondage using the law. And what we find with this disparity in sentencing in America is that the same kind of thing is happening. And corporations are taking full advantage of this pool of resources, this labor pool. Let me just tell you five corporations in America right now who use inmate labor as a part of their production arm. And some of the names might surprise you. One is Boeing, okay? So people should probably wonder or think sometimes when they're flying in Boeing jets if some of these planes were put together by people making 9 cents an hour in prisons in America. Likewise, McDonald's. Another is Starbucks, which I'm sure many of your listeners probably had some Starbucks this morning. For the ladies out there, let me apologize ahead of time. Victoria's Secrets. Is another one that uses inmate labor to produce their products. Texas Instruments are another. So some of the biggest and most profitable corporations in America are utilizing this pool of inmate resources.
Well, and to me, that there's two issues that come to mind with that. The first, when you were mentioning about the corporations that own the majority of the private prisons, I think people need to look at the fact of saying, who do these people use their money to promote in the elections? You know,
exactly.
If they're backing a particular candidate in the election, why are they doing that? Are they doing that out of the goodness of their heart? Or are they doing that because that candidate is going to help them put more people in their prisons? I mean, you know, let's get right to it. I mean, that's, you know, so, but people need to be educated enough to know who is behind this? So
that's great. You're absolutely right, Alan. Just point of fact, the GEO Group spent $22 billion in the last calendar year on lobbyists promoting their agenda. Now, any corporation that's spending $2 billion to lobby has an agenda, and that agenda is designed to bring them not just that $22 billion back, but a considerable amount more. So we're talking big business here, and part of what we do out here, and you mentioned my being involved with Colorado Criminal Justice Reform Coalition, we understand that things systemically are broken and need to be fixed. And that's one thing that a lot of qualified people that are dedicated to this effort. Where it concerns Second Chance Center and the work that we do, we have to try to separate with our clients that feeling or that inclination to blame a system and turn it back to them as being someone able to be empowered in their own life, regardless of these things that are set in place to make that more difficult or, in some cases, near impossible.
Well, you know, that's, you know, I hope that each state has, you know, has a similar committee that is looking into, you know, how we can make changes, because we're definitely going in the wrong direction. You know, being a country that continues to incarcerate more and more people, and as you said, cutting the budgets for education, that was an issue that we had here in California as well. And I spoke to a lot of people in high government positions, you know, trying to point out to them that, you know, if, you know, you may think that you're saving X amount here by cutting back the budget in special needs, but how many of these people are now going to go in a different direction? And as you said, you know, spending over $30,000 a year because you're going to be incarcerating them at a later date.
Well, you know, I think you talk about education being so important on these issues, Alan, and I agree. But some people are very comfortable in a position of denial and just thinking about how their own personal lives or families are impacted by things. Let me just try to bring it home a little closer for most people. Okay. I don't know if general population is aware that 98%, at least 98% of the people currently incarcerated in America's prisons will one day be released. Okay? So the question comes to mind then is, what type of individual are you hoping to be released, and what's going to be out there available to help assist them in reintegrating into the community? Those are the questions, because most people are coming back out. And when we think about the cost, we talk about dollars and cents, it costs far less for community-based organizations and other people involved in this reentry work to help someone navigate the challenges of coming back into the community, finding a job, becoming a tax-paying, supportive member of their family and their community, than it does to have people reincarcerated. In the state of Colorado, 42% of those sent back to prison after their release are not sent back for new crimes, Alan. They're sent back for technical violations. They can't keep up with the payments for their UAs, or they fall behind in their halfway house assistance fees, or for some other reason they move without prior approval of their parole officer or their probation officer. These kinds of things, not new offenses against community. So it's a constant recycling of these individuals back into a system, and we think that's just not cost effective if people are concerned about their taxes and their state budgets.
Again, a great point. It sounds like, I mean, our two biggest areas of concern should be, one, educating up front and at a young age so that we have fewer people going in to begin with. And then secondly, when people are incarcerated, focus more of your funding on rehabilitation and employment. Let's come up with ways to get people employed so that there is less of an opportunity or a reason to, you know, if you can't afford, as you were saying, you can't afford to pay for you know, for part of your halfway house, or you can't, you know, you have to move because you can't afford that particular place and you don't report. You know, now we're putting them back in a situation because they couldn't make a whatever, you know, a couple hundred dollar payment. We're going to put them back in a situation to where it's costing the taxpayers $30,000 a year. Just
absolutely
doesn't make sense.
Not at all.
Frustrating. Guys, I just looked up. We've only got about 5 minutes, and I want to make sure that if there's some specific things that you guys want to touch on, that we have time. And I also want to get to another question that came in. This one reads, my brother has become dependent on painkillers and marijuana after hurting his back at work. It has led to other problems and even more serious drugs. His entire mindset is excuse-driven without taking responsibility for his actions. After being arrested, his life is now in a downward spiral. My parents and I are panicked about his future. Mr. Lateef, would your book be of help to him? Thank you from JC in Pasadena.
JC, that was a great comment, and I'm sorry to hear that you and your family are going through this. I believe that the book would be of some help, and I feel like it's a shameless plug, but I'm going to tell you, Alan, I could be having more commercial success had I done what publishers wanted me to do and make it some HBO Oz type war story collection. But that's not the offering. We offer in this book what we think are steps to help navigate challenges, and substance abuse and substance dependency is a critical component in our approach to our mentoring curriculum. And this is not unusual, what JC described. We see it happening quite a bit with people coming back from active military service, mm-hmm. who are suffering from PTSD and other kinds of afflictions and not having those things addressed properly. And so I would hope so. We have a access on our website for people who have questions, and if feel free to go to the site and ask whatever questions. If there's some way we can connect them to resources or we can answer a question, we'll be more than happy to do that. I'll steer them in a direction we think they might be able to resolve an issue. So we encourage people to take advantage of that.
Okay, and again, that website, for those, if you're in a position where you can write it down, please grab a pen and write this down. If you're driving and you can't, you can go to our website, Answers, the numeral for the family. You can go to our .com. You can go to our website. We will have all of their information there. But again, it is www.sccolorado.org. So there's three C's in there. So sccolorado.org. If you go there, you can you can pose your questions there. And Hassan, for those people that are still more comfortable with a telephone, is there a number they can call as well?
Absolutely. They can call 303-537-5838. Well, Alan, they can call my cell phone number, which is 720-297-9694. Now, you kind of chuckled a little bit, but we have our cell phone numbers on all of our business cards at Second Chance Center because we want folks to have access to somebody that'll listen, somebody
You're right.
that'll be there to hear, and so that's why we do it. And likewise, if anyone wanted that book sent to their loved one, their family member inside, we have the capacity to do that as well.
That's great. And Hassan, what that was a synergy smile because it was a synergy smile because with what we do with young people, we, you know, everybody has my cell phone number also. So again, it was that was definitely a form of synergy. Gentlemen,
well,
I wish that we had more time. Again, you know, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate what you're doing. You know, I synergize with you from the standpoint of recognizing the fact that this is a trend that is just going in the wrong direction, and we need people's help. These gentlemen need your help. They're out there doing what needs to be done. And so, again, go to the website. You know, if you don't have you know, if you don't have something like this in your own state, in your own county, in your own city or whatever, form one. You know, think about, you know, the direction that we want to have for our next generation. You know, if you go to their website, you'll probably be able to see some ways in which you may be able to help. So again, Hassan and Sean, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. And Alan, I would suggest and encourage you to invite Sean back where you just have time with him and your listeners. And I encourage you to do that, brother.
Thank you. And again, I appreciate that. That's why I realize that, you know, this is a show that definitely needs more time. So thank you for that. And for everybody out there, be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.